Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can get our weekly newsletter for $3 a month and unlock bonus episodes for $5 a month. You also get access to ad-free versions of the podcast. We recently released a bonus episode on Why the Last Man and have shows in the works on No Time to Die and Lamb. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here with
Scott Tobias.
Tasha and Genevieve are too busy sipping banana daiquiris in Cuba to participate this week. In their place, we brought in special guest Jason Bailey. You may have read Jason's work in the New York Times or one of his books, including his latest, Fun City Cinema, New York City, and the Movies That Made It, which also has an accompanying podcast. Hello, Jason.
Well, I think this is the part where I should artfully crossfade to an image of myself 10 or 12 years ago reading the AV Club and hoping to one day write that well, which is a long way of going about saying what a pleasure it is to be here with the two of you. So thank you for having me.
Yeah. And real quickly, is your book out now or is it when is it out?
October 26th is the current release date.
It is by the time this comes out. It'll be there.
Great. Yeah. That's our, I believe, our fourth release date, but I think this one's going to stick. I'm pretty sure. Feel good about this one.
Could get punted to March at the last minute, as I know. All right. So here's the thing. Is everyone on board with the plan?
What plan?
The one I sent over. You guys didn't get it?
What?
No, I have no idea. No, there's no plan.
Okay. What? It would have been helpful if you read it, but here's the deal. Instead of our usual structure, we're going to break format with these episodes. Part one will be exactly the same, a straightforward podcast episode. But in part two, we're going to employ a lyrical editing structure. It will feature our thoughts on the movies we're pairing, but also moments of contrast to events that happened years before the first episode.
Wait, what?
And are you ready for this? Our parts will be played by a community theater troupe. They'll be joining us in a bit to play our parents as they reenact scenarios that find meaningful connections between the past and the present and illustrate how our lives were shaped by events that took place long ago. Who's ready?
I am not.
I'm definitely not.
It honestly sounds like kind of a disaster. And isn't the format of our podcast such that we're already exploring connections between past and present?
Okay, one sec. No, they didn't go for it. Sorry. Yeah, I know you were looking forward to it. Costumes and everything, huh? Ah, jeez. I told you this is a podcast. Yeah, Charles Fleischer recorded his part of Roger Rabbit while wearing a rabbit costume. No, I didn't know that. Look, I'll call you later. Okay, Scott, maybe you should tell us about our pairing if you feel so strongly about our regular format.
I'm up for experimentation, but this sounded like a terrible idea. So for our next two episodes, we're talking about gangsters and crime and flashbacks and prequels via two films set in the mafia underworld. Both follow-ups to some of the most acclaimed and influential mafia stories ever told. First, we'll be discussing Francis Ford Coppola's 1974 film, The Godfather Part II, a sequel to the Best Picture-winning 1972 film, The Godfather, that itself took home the Best Picture Oscar. Split across two timelines, the film divides its time between Michael Corleone, played by Al Pacino, as he expands the Corleone empire into Nevada, and his father Vito, played as an adult by Robert De Niro, as he, like his son, begins a life of crime almost by accident. In the second installment, we'll make connections between Coppola's film and The Many Saints of Newark, a prequel to the groundbreaking TV series The Soprano, set in the hotbed of late 60s, early 70s New Jersey.
So get ready for a double feature of gangsters in their tender years and their not-so-tender years set at turning points in American history. Starting with a classic that didn't necessarily seem like a good idea at the time, moving on to an instantly divisive addition to a famous show's lore. Please join us after the break.
history of two generations of crime. The drama of absolute power and the men who violate it. The Godfather, Part 2.
What is your name?
Don Vito Corleone and his son Michael. Both had seen the ones they loved most cut down before their eyes. Both had killed as an act of vengeance. Both commanded the most powerful and merciless crime organization in the world.
Is it true that in the year 1950, you devised the murder of the heads of the so-called five families in New York?
It's a complete falsehood.
They would take any measures.
I mean, you've won. You want to wipe everybody out?
I don't feel I have to wipe everybody out, Tom. Just my enemies.
Francis Ford Coppola didn't want to make a sequel to The Godfather, though the film had brought him success on a scale he never experienced in his still young, already tumultuous career. Not only had it enjoyed wild popularity, it won Coppola widespread acclaim on its way to winning Oscars for Best Picture, Best Actor for Marlon Brando, and Best Adapted Screenplay for Coppola and Mario Puzo, author of the book on which it was based. But making it had been hard. Coppola had butted heads with executives at Paramount, particularly producer Robert Evans, and the complicated shoot had proven exhausting. Coppola wanted to make his own smaller movies like The Conversation, a study in paranoia and isolation that would also earn a Best Picture nomination in 1974. "You've got the recipe for Coca-Cola," Paramount's Charlie Bloodhorn told him before asking, "and you don't want to make any more bottles?" He did not. In fact, Coppola tried to set up his friend Martin Scorsese with the job. Eventually, Paramount won him back, but Coppola agreed only on the condition that he be given total control to make the movie he wanted. Paramount agreed. When you've got the recipe for Coca-Cola, you can make those sorts of demands. What Coppola wanted to make, even before taking on The Godfather Part II, was a story of fathers and sons set across two timelines. From Puzo's novel, he took the story of Vito Corleone's early days in America, an unfilmed section of the book that follows Vito as he meets the core crew of what will become the Corleone crime family and begins his ascent into the criminal underworld. To that, working in collaboration with Puzo, he added the next chapter in the Corleone story, one in which the reluctant mob boss Michael Corleone's promise to take the family business legitimate has mostly meant escalating the scale and scope of its crimes. The Godfather Part II is a sprawling film about how families come together, how they fall apart, and how it's sometimes impossible to tell the difference. Where The Godfather ended with Michael, once a proud veteran who'd sworn to stay out of the family business, taking the reins of his family's empire and distancing himself from his wife Kay, played by Diane Keaton, and the person he once imagined himself to be. Part two begins several years later, with Michael as a confident but hollowed-out man. The empire has grown, but the family with which it was once synonymous has frayed. In the end, he can only really save one. But rather than just a tale of decline and fall, it's also a story of sealed fates. Young Vito's murderous professional career inevitably leads to the death of his loved ones and the loss of Michael's soul. In one of the flashback sequences, Vito accompanies his shady friend Clemenza, played by Bruno Kirby, to retrieve a rug he claims a friend has given him as a gift. Vito comes to realize he's participating in a break-in, but if he has any choice, he goes along anyway. He brings the blood-red rug home and places his infant child, Sonny, on it, where Sonny begins crying as if recognizing the transgression will lead to his own bloody death years later. Coppola's original Godfather brought poetry to the story that, on the page, is as irresistible as it is pulpy. Part two doesn't lose the bloody intrigue, wringing thrills from both Vito's cool handling of the neighborhood boss he displaces and from Michael's power struggle. That puts him up against the seemingly generous rival ganglord, Hyman Roth, played by famed acting teacher Lee Strasberg in a rare big screen role, and requires Michael to search for the traitor in his midst. But the film also doubles down on the poetry, following the story of an immigrant discovering what it takes to make it in his new home into the dark heart of American politics. Ideals don't mean anything. Family does. Michael uses the Corleone business to gain riches and power, but loses everything that matters along the way. But maybe, the film's swinging pendulum structure asks, he never had any say in the matter anyway. That the darkness enveloping him as the film draws to a close started to form years ago and many miles away.
Hey,
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'll change. I've learned that I have the strength to change. And you'll forget about this miscarriage. And we'll have another child. And we'll go on. You and I. We'll go on.
Oh, Michael. Michael, you are blind. It wasn't a miscarriage. It was an abortion. An abortion, Michael. Just like our marriage is an abortion. Something that's unholy and evil. I didn't want your son, Michael. I wouldn't bring another one of your sons into this world. It was an abortion, Michael. It was a son, and I had it killed because this must all end. I know now that it's over. I knew it then. There would be no way, Michael, no way you could ever forgive me. Not with this Sicilian thing.
So everyone, I don't think anyone has seen this film for the first time. What's your history with The Godfather Part II? Jason, you're a special guest. Tell me about your history with this film.
It's actually, I recall this so vividly. I saw both Godfather 1 and 2 in December of 1990, which I remember so clearly because HBO was airing them both in the run-up to the release of Godfather 3 that month.
Hmm.
So they ran both of those films. They also debuted the Godfather Family, A Look Inside documentary, which is very good and has all those great, like, you know, all of the audition tapes from, you know, of De Niro playing Sonny and all that sort of thing. And I had only heard of these films. I had never seen any of them. I had just turned 15. So my dad decided that I was old enough to see them. And 15 in 1990, if that doesn't age me enough, I will add that we taped them on VHS from HBO and I watched them. And then Godfather 3, like a couple weeks later when it came out in theaters. So just binged the entire series at that time, and which I think genuinely affected how I responded to each of them in different ways.
Yeah, I think I similarly taped these off of HBO. We didn't have HBO, but my parents' friends did, and they would let me tape things off and didn't really ask too many questions about what I was taping, because I don't think I would have been allowed to watch the Godfather films openly. but they're quite an impression on me. I there's definitely films I've come back to again and again. And I think I certainly have to point, I'd probably seen The Godfather, the first one, more than the second, because it is an easier watch in many ways, a more traditionally entertaining film, and also shorter. But yeah, I really love this film. I love the way the two fit together.
Yeah, I can't even recall when I saw this film or The Godfather. It feels like these films have just kind of been there for as long as I can remember. It's just that, you know, but though I don't think I've ever seen either one of them, the first and second one, projected before. I think
I've seen them both. Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah.
I mean, because I would love those infamous dark rooms, I think would probably play a better on a big screen, Gordon Willis's kind of interiors that was a serious bone of contention with Robert Evans, among many other issues. But, you know, I guess that what's kind of toggled back in my forth in my mind is, like, you know, which is the better of the two? Because I don't really know. I mean, I think that, you know, and I think for most of my adult life, I think I've ended up leaning towards this one. Because the scope of it is so astonishing. It's just like, it feels like the ultimate immigration epic, you know, in addition to being, you know, a pretty satisfying gangster film. But at the same time, of course, the first one has, I think, the storytelling, the anecdotes, you know, it's kind of juicier in its way than the second, which maybe gets a little mucked up. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself on that front, because I probably will talk about the two films in comparison. But the way Coppola sort of draws these timelines together and these men together, the techniques he uses to do so, that the moments he uses to do so are so powerful, and just the richness of the texture of the film, just, you know, just that was the true of The Godfather as well, of just you know, getting every, you know, getting the music right, getting the decor right, you know, just kind of you feel just so utterly immersed, you know, in the world of these films, and certainly in the world of The Godfather 2 is such an expansive one, because we see so many areas. We see Ellis Island, we see Sicily, we see New York at two different periods, and it's just, it's in every instance, it's you know, Lake Tahoe, we see all of this stuff, and it's all so fully realized and beyond the storytelling, which is in its own way quite masterful.
Yeah, we may as well get into like comparisons here. I think one way of talking about it is talking about something that is a disastrous idea that has been executed, which was showing these chronologically. There is Coppola has said he does not prefer that edit, and yet there is an edit of them telling the story, taking all the flashbacks from part two and putting them ahead of all the action in part one. And to me, I think it is that structure that elevates part two a little bit above the first one. The rhymes there and the connections and all that is so beautifully done. I mean, I talked about that rug scene. It is really one of my favorite moments in movies ever, because I think it's an effect that you can't really accomplish in quite the same way, at least in any other medium.
Okay, so I know I've listened to enough of the show to know that sort of it falls to the third person to take a slightly contrarian point of view.
That's just Tasha. Yeah.
Just Tasha. Okay, well, I am filling in, so that is part of my role. I don't want to for a moment put across the notion that I believe Godfather Part II to be anything less than a great American film. It obviously is. It's a pretty stunning achievement. All of that said, I have never subscribed to what I feel like has almost become the predominant conventional wisdom that Godfather 2 eclipses the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why. Well, first of all, I should say the one in sort of an addendum to what I had said earlier, I hadn't seen the Godfather films before I saw all of them in that month-long stretch in 1990. But I had by that time owned for a couple of years and probably memorized portions of the Roger Ebert movie Home Companion. And Mr. Ebert notoriously gave Godfather Part II a 3 out of 4 star review in the Sun-Times and in that volume, thus, compared to the obvious 4 stars of the first film. And there's a part of me that, you know, feels it's quite plausible that because I was so influenced by him and I had read those reviews before seeing the movie, that they certainly steered my thinking on the comparative merits of the two films. But I genuinely believe that the first film is it's so tight. Every single beat in that movie pays off. Everything that's there is there for a reason. It's not a slickness, because there's a, that has, you know, that's a negative connotation to that. It just feels, it's everything. It's a perfect motion picture to me.
Yeah.
And The Godfather Part II is a messier motion picture than that, which in a lot of ways I think is admirable. But the key thought that I always go back to when I'm thinking of them in comparison to each other is the kicker of that Ebert review, that original 1974 Ebert review, which I went and looked up again to make sure I remembered it correctly, which is: the stunning text of The Godfather is replaced in Part Two with prologues, epilogues, footnotes, and good intentions.
Yeah.
I've always kind of felt the same way. I've always felt that all of, you know, that it really does feel like it's sort of a bunch of different things kind of mashed together in a way that the first film does not, in a way that the first film pointedly does not. And that there are little things in it that bother me in a way that nothing did in the first film. This is after watching both of them countless times for many, many years. I've sort of maintained that point of view about them comparative to each other.
I wonder also if my influence goes the opposite way, because I didn't have the, I've read a lot of Ebert since then, but I didn't grow up with the Ebert books. I grew up with Leonard Maltin's movie, Home Companion, or Home Movie Companion, or whatever it's called. I think the title changed over the years, but where Godfather Part II gets 4 stars, The Godfather gets 3.5 stars.
Interesting.
Yeah, which I can't imagine.
Yeah, I mean, to me, they're both whatever, 4 stars out of 4 or 5 yeah. stars. I mean, I love them both. I think that I would say, the one thing I would say going against Part Two is I think all of the stuff involving Hyman Roth and Fredo and Cuba, I feel like there's something murky in the storytelling there.
I think it was like the third time I saw this film that I finally figured out.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, like, he's like, wait, you're thinking Hyman Roth is behind? Like, how is that possible? So, you know, it's that part of it is murky in a way that absolutely is not. I mean, the first film, there's nothing. It's as you say, a perfect film because it's so clear. But I just think the poetics of this film, as Keith calls them, like the juxtaposition of these two stories. I think the purposefulness of the Vito part of it with De Niro. I mean, I don't know. Ebert is super wrong about that. I mean, because I feel like that part of the movie is absolutely tight as a drum, and I don't know how you cannot watch that and not be extremely impressed, rather than just kind of like cast it off as sort of an epilogue, rather than an incredibly important story about, you know, the legacy of this family and how it began and what it says about America. And then it gets into politics and all. I mean, it's such a, I think it's a richer text to kind of dig into for me than The Godfather. I think Godfather is just a much more gripping film overall and more and tighter film overall. It's just, I don't know. It's hard to, they're good. They're good films. These are good films.
Controversial opinion there.
Yeah.
Firing up the hot take. And the only other thing that bothers me about Godfather Part Two, it's not even something I dislike, but because I understand fully, I've read enough about it to know that it was entirely out of Coppola's control, is that the substitution of Frankie Pantangeli for Clemenza is so clumsy and sticks out even more because we have all of this material in the flashback section with the young Clemenza.
Yeah. Just for a little background for people who don't know, Richard Castellano, who played Clemenza in the first film, did not return, as Coppola tells it. I guess there are some disputing accounts, because he, not because of money, but because he wanted his friend to write all his dialogue for him, and Coppola would not agree to this, somewhat understandably. So basically, apart from a couple of lines saying, oh, isn't it too bad Clemenza died, they basically just did a find replace on the screenplay and dropped in Frank Pantangeli. And here's the thing. I think that's a great performance, though.
Absolutely.
Michael Gazzo is he's got that amazing voice and just everything about it. I think I really do like his work. So that doesn't really bother me. And in fact, if I didn't know the backstory, I might not even think about it that much at all.
Yeah, actually, I didn't actually not know that. I'm learning something. I didn't know about that backstory either.
If you know it going in, it's much more apparent than if you like discover it after the fact.
So you're saying this guy should have had somebody else write his dialogue?
I'm absolutely not. That's what I'm saying. Like, I realize it was a no-win situation, but I almost feel like maybe Bruno Kirby should have played the young Frankie, if that was, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like that portion of the back and forth of the past and present is so, it's more jarring because we're meeting the younger version of that character.
We could see the origins of the wagon wheel coffee table. Sorry, gotta eat your.
Yeah, the other one they had to rescue on the fly was the final scene, which is the dinner scene where all where James Caan is there and all the other characters are from the original film are there, except for conspicuously Marlon Brando, who it was written for him to be there and it just didn't work out. So they kind of had to, I think that was up to the day of shooting. There's a possibility that he would be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's another thing, but I think that scene is lovely the way it is though.
He was the Kyrie Irving of his time.
Yes, he was. He refused to get vaccinated to show up for the scene. But I don't know, but I mean, I think maybe if you didn't know that, it wouldn't bother you. I think you might be onto something there, but there are a few more tattered ends in this film, admittedly, but I also think that in some way makes it, you know, there's a lot more to dig into as well in some ways.
That's true.
Yeah. With this one. Yeah. I just think that the opening of this film is just like breathtaking. I mean, just all that stuff at Ellis Island is just so many. What's the word I can use that isn't the word iconic to describe all of those images?
Yeah,
imagine a word that hasn't been egregiously overused and misused that is the same as iconic, because that is kind of describes all of the images there of the Statue of Liberty, of the, you know, the, both of them as the boat approaches it, and then an incredible shot of the of young Vito in his room, very sick, and looking out with that kind of juxtaposition. It's just like, it's awe-inspiring, that image.
It's stunning stuff, too. And here's where Jason's expertise comes in. So you have the whole section set in the early, in turn of the century, New York. I don't know that I've ever seen that period realized quite as richly in another film. So am I wrong there? Can you point to other examples? Or what about this depiction of that period of New York history sets this film apart?
No, it's absolutely. I mean, everything that I've read was, you know, one of the things that's interesting when you're reading about the production of both films is that, you know, no expense was spared in the making of Godfather 2 in a way that was quite different from the making of Godfather 1, where Paramount was trying to spend as little money as possible and paying everyone as little as possible, and had floated relocating the story to contemporary Kansas City as a way to save money. None of those monetary concerns were raised on part two. They kind of, you know, that was, from what I understand, part of luring him to do it was sort of writing him a blank check. So the trouble that they went to recreate that sort of stretch of New York City and doing it in, you know, on the Lower East Side, in the sort of the area that had been in an Italian enclave and an immigrant enclave in that era, was sort of unparalleled and was not an area that was really captured on film at the time either. I think sort of the closest you get is if you look at, and I don't recommend watching it for much of anything else, The Jazz Singer, which is one of the films that we profile in the book. That's that area around, you know, 1927 or so, 1926, which it had changed, but in a lot of ways it was still the same. You're still getting sort of those views of, you know, the push carts and the sort of vibrancy of the neighborhood and the hustle bustle of those streets. And those shots were captured at the real Lower East Side via like hidden cameras and like laundry trucks and stuff like that. But yeah, from what I understand, you know, no expense was spared. Extensive research was done, and they really took that street over for a good couple, 3 weeks during the production of the movie, and really transformed it back to its heyday.
Yeah, it's really quite remarkable. It is one of those recreations where you feel like you could just walk into a shop and order whatever they're selling, as if you travel through time. We should talk a little bit about how there's so much. I don't even know. There's so much going on here. I'm not even really sure where to talk about it, but maybe a little bit in terms of where Coppola was in his career, because it had been an up and down career already at this point. And obviously this was The Godfather was a huge up. This comes out the same year as The Conversation, which is just remarkable to me. Cause I think there's that run of films is, I don't want to say unparalleled, but it's certainly as good as anyone else's, you know, the run from Godfather through Apocalypse Now.
It's just the four films, but it covers the 70s pretty well.
It's true. That decade is as good as a decade as anyone once had. But, you know, I'm not even sure, go back a little bit further, what in the filmography suggested he was equipped to take on the first Godfather. And this, to me, feels like it is an undertaking on a scale several sizes larger than that, at a point where he had said he just kind of wanted to make his own small personal films. And this is personal, but it's definitely not small.
Could we credit Robert Evans for this? I mean, somebody had to be able to see in Finian's Rainbow, in The Rain People, in, you know, Dimension 13 or whatever. I mean, you had to see in some of those 60s films. And then what's the kind of comedy that he did as well? You're Big Boy Now?
Big Boy Now.
I mean, he had to see in those films somebody who could pull this off. And I mean, I think it was kind of a thought, like, the thought was like, he's an Italian.
That was a huge part of it, especially considering the sort of blowback they were already getting from like Italian American groups who were concerned about portraiture. The fact that they were sort of making the gesture of hiring an Italian American director was pretty important, from what I understand. It also helped, to go back to the earlier point, they were able to get him cheap because he hadn't really had a hit yet. But in terms of the filmography, I think there's less in his what he had directed to that point that points, if not to Godfather, then definitely to Godfather 2, than the screenplay to Patton.
Right.
Which, oh, God, lest we forget, he won an Oscar for, you know? So, like, that was kind of the thing he was best known for. And that, again, is a sort of a big canvas, American with a capital A story. I think that's sort of our most direct link previously. And then, of course, in the future, this was his first, you know, big canvas, big epic, impossible to think of Apocalypse Now without Godfather 2 in between them.
Yeah, and I think you could also say that in terms of the films he directed, I mean, Finian's Rainbow is a flawed film, but it is a big film. It is a film that of scale. Yeah, sure. So you can at least trust that he's worked with those kind of tools before, if not as successfully as folks would have wanted. But it makes sense. I completely forgot about the Patton thing, of course. Mm-hmm. That is a great point on that as being something it would be... You'll fill you with a certain amount of confidence that he might be able to get it done, but it's still a gamble. I mean, by no means an established directorial talent, and really, even if you watch and admired some of those earlier films, and I personally am a very big fan of The Rain People, like
beautiful movie.
You don't see it. You don't necessarily think, oh, this guy's going to be able to do something like The Godfather.
Yeah.
And I don't think maybe they couldn't have. I mean, who can anticipate a film that good being made anyway? Maybe you just anticipate somebody carrying your gangster epic over the line and it being entertaining and people paying to see it. They don't really, you can't necessarily expect someone to deliver a masterpiece for you on this level.
I think people love this movie, but I think people are... there's an affection for the first Godfather. This film doesn't quite inspire. And I think it's part because the Godfather has these vibrant characters like Michael and Kay and Fredo,
Sonny.
And Sonny. And by Godfather 2, Sonny's dead, and everyone else is kind of these wan, you know, disappointment laden. You're burdened by disappointment versions of themselves. I mean, Pacino's
corpse
performance
people
in this film,
almost.
It is almost he's not quite human in this film, and that's not a criticism of the performance in any way. It's exactly what the movie needs, but it's, you know, there's none of the vibrancy or emotion. I mean, when you get to that dinner scene, it's shocking to see how different a character Michael is in that timeline, and Fredo as well, and sort of the warmth and affection and the sort of nothing can tear us apart feeling you have for this family. I mean, the tragedy is so deep. The idea that this group that you know expressed a love for family above all is destroying. You know, the family is destroyed by the end of the film. In all but name.
It's impossible to overstate the weight of Brando's performance in the first film and the warmth of that character and the sort of paternal familial, you know, the sense that we get of that in that film of this, you know, a man who's capable of being very cold and ruthless, but who we mostly see as this paternalistic, warm, accommodating figure. And that's absent entirely from the way Michael's running the family by the time part two starts.
But I think he's so completely poisoned, Michael is, by the end of that first film. I mean, you know, when we meet him, he's a war hero, right? Or he's leading a pretty normal life, or trying to anyway. I mean, he's certainly a very different person by the end. He's arranged this conclusion to the tensions between the five families.
That's one way of putting it, Scott.
He has cut Kay out of his life, of course, famously. And so as Key was saying, yeah, that we do get a very, when we start with him, he is a fully corrupted, fully ruthless person without much family left, except for Fredo, who is Fredo.
Yeah, and I want to dig into some of the individual performances, but maybe start with Robert Duvall's performance as Tom Hagen, because I think that's the character that, on the surface at least, changes the least between the two films. And there is sort of an innate kindliness and gentleness to it. And then you kind of have to step back and realize he's probably has more blood on his hands directly or one step away from having blood on his hands than almost any other characters, because the echo of the horse's head in this is the murder of the prostitute, which is, you know, almost certainly arranged by Tom and carried out by Al Neary. And, you know, this is someone who his demeanor and ability to carry himself in such a way to suggest that he would be completely incapable of such an act hides the fact that he is completely capable of such acts. It's one of the most understated performances in these films, and I think it's one of the best as well.
And I think that it also kind of suggests a certain type of power being wielded by non-Italians in a way. Mm-hmm. Like you know, you see it in politicians as well. And if you get into The Godfather 3, into the people with religious backgrounds, I mean, just it's a subtler type of gangsterism taking place. It's you know, he's behind the scenes, he's dictating things. But of course, as Keith said, that will that is being executed is resulting in a tremendous amount of loss. And it is a very subtle performance. Both films, Duvall is like, you don't forget him exactly, but he's exactly the shadowy figure that both the Corleone family needs him to be and that the character, I guess, demands.
There's a tiny Duvall moment that I never really paid a lot of attention to that leapt out at me on this viewing, which is when Michael's given him the third degree about, you know, the job offer that he didn't take, or and he talks about moving his entire family out there and then says very coldly, you know, and your mistress. And the way that Duvall sort of reacts to that, the flipness of the way that Michael says that. And also it sort of jolted me because it's like, you know, like you say, in spite of the fact that he is really this cold-blooded, you know, figure with all this blood on his hands, I still think of him as like a good family man, you know, and like to be reminded of his darker self in that moment is really sort of startling.
Beyond Duvall, I offered up Duvall. What are some performances that stand out for you guys?
I like Robert De Niro.
Yeah,
in this film, I think he's pretty good.
He's a promising young man. He might be going places.
Well, I just think that this period of Robert De Niro, you know, I guess it would have been a couple of years after Mean Streets. He's just so electric. Like, he's so dangerous that, you know, and he's so charismatic too. He's like got all the, because he's got all of this charisma, but it's kind of a dark charisma and a little bit wild. But I guess the difference, of course, is that, you know, is that Vito is not a complete screw up in the way that his character in Mean Streets was. He has a, you know, and he has a very clear vision of where he needs to go and what he needs to do. I mean, it's a very instinctual based, you know, circumstantial of just like, I have the family, I need to survive. You know, this is going to be the route to do that. And you just see step by step him, you know, doing what it takes to kind of move up the ladder. And you know, I mean, if he doesn't lose his job as a grocer, I mean, do either of these movies ever happen? You know, mm-hmm. And of course that's hastened by the intervention of a gangster. So the culture sort of ends up directing his life. But I don't think there's any kind of impulse necessarily to be a criminal or build a criminal empire. It's just you see that slippage, that step by step and De Niro handles it with just such poise and danger and just it's an incredible performance.
A lot of acting on his face and not with his words in this one too.
Yeah, and not the face, not the
no,
face,
not that the ooh, that face, no,
that face.
That makes in every film. But
yeah, people know you don't have to. You know, they can't see you making the face, but they know what the face is.
Yeah,
you know, I've seen the movie so many times that I find myself on this degree of a rewatch, noticing performances I haven't paid as much attention to before. This time, I really found myself watching Talia Shire a lot.
Yeah.
Who I think we're so prone to dismissiveness in cases of nepotism that I think she doesn't really get due for not only how good she is in each of these films, but for the sort of incredible arc of the character over these three films. And in the first movie, it's kind of a nothing role. I mean, she's there and she's the cute little sister and she, you know, does what she does well, but there's not a lot of screen time there. And in this one, it's just so striking the journey she's been on between the end of one and the beginning of two, the way she's sort of coming on as the black sheep at the beginning of this film, the way that she arrives at the party after the communion ceremony and is sort of, you know, berated by Mama Corleone and just the clear mess that she's made of her life in the intervening years. And then just every time she reappears throughout the film, it's very purposeful. She's serving the story in a really interesting way. The way in which she kind of brokers what looks to be the peace between Michael and Fredo, at least temporarily. That scene in particular struck me, having revisited three not long ago, as really key in sort of the role that she serves in the story in Godfather 3, where she really has become something of a power broker within the family. I think it's a really sharp, keenly felt performance.
Yeah, and I think the journey she goes on within the film as well, the way she ends up as coming back into the fold and also kind of turning into a true believer beyond that too, it's kind of chilling.
Yeah,
that's a great performance. And John, we should say John Cazale is also quite good.
I mean, so good. Just
kind of want to hit all the obvious ones here.
Right.
Pacino, good work. Pacino,
There's so few Cazale performances. But I think you're kind of wondering if you're overestimating the achievement, but you look at every one of them and he's so good in every single one of them. It's awful what we were deprived of with his loss. Yeah.
I mean, there's obvious, you know, weakness there, but along with that weakness, like a vulnerability that you can kind of connect to as well, that makes that character, you know, a tragic character and not just a foolish character.
Yeah, right. The desperation of those last couple of scenes with Michael, you know, how clear it is that he, that in losing his you know, his line into his family, that he's lost everything. There's nothing left there. Is so heartbreaking, even aware of what he's done. It's really, really a tremendous piece of work.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I'm thinking about, you know, this is a film of very big famous moments, and we can list them off. I we haven't mentioned how good Diane Keaton is throughout the film, but especially in her famous confrontation with Michael, and the look on Pacino. It's threatening to turn into the Chris Farley show. It's like, do you remember that look on Pacino's face when she tells him? Exactly. But are there any smaller details that stood out for you? One for me is, I know I noticed it before, but I love how modestly Hyman Roth lives, and like just this very, you know, inconspicuous Florida suburban home. I mean, that to me is a really telling detail.
Yeah, like what is he doing? What is all the scheming actually for? Like, where is it all going?
Yeah,
he may have been dying of the same heart attack for however many years or whatever, but at the same time, he is much nearer to his end of his life than his beginning. There is a question of what is all this for? I mean, it all kind of comes down to the famous Chinatown exchange. Like, how much money do you need? You know, and that's kind of at the heart of a lot of this as well.
I was really, you know, because we're thinking about, you know, past and present talking to each other, I was really tuned in to the crossfades this time in a way, just paying specific attention to them in a way that I haven't always, and was really struck by the beauty of them and how beautifully they're communicating with each other visually, how many of them are sort of Michael on one side of the screen, and then we crossfade to, you know, young Vito on the other, and the way that those emotions that each of them are having are often complementary to each other, but sometimes also speak to the differences between them at those moments. That was really striking to me this time around. And then the other thing that jumped out at me, and it is a small thing, but because I was thinking about this movie in relation to The Sopranos, was you mentioned the thing with the rug and with Sonny, which is a beautiful moment. The sequence where they actually steal the rug, the sort of delicate intermingling of incongruent tones in that sequence struck me as very influential on The Sopranos. The way that it sort of starts as a comedy sequence, because, you know, you got Bruno Kirby's playing, which is, you know, he's a terrific comic actor. The way that it's initially scored with that sort of jaunty music and, you know, and the comedy of him saying, oh, I guess he forgot I was coming, you know. But then how quickly it turns dark and he becomes menacing in that great shot where the cop is, you know, the silhouette of the cop is in the door and he's next to the door holding the gun. And the way that the shift on a dime in that moment, like, really takes your breath away. And then they cut right back to comedy with them carrying it through the street, and the jaunty music is back, and just the ability to intermingle those tones without giving an audience whiplash, I think is really, again, is striking there and also a clear key to how they navigated those tones on The Sopranos.
And I guess I've got a couple of moments. One of them just silly. Who's the name of the gangster that is running streets before Vito comes up? What is his name?
Oh, the guy from the Black Hand. Finucci.
Finucci, right? Yeah. So I of course.
You think of
Homer. Notice the scene of him kind of there's a scene of him sort of walking around that is the clear visual inspiration for the Simpsons dream sequence where Homer imagines himself as a gangster saying grazie, that's a nice donut.
Yep
exactly the same. Like I didn't realize until watching it again now that it was just shot for shot, like the exact same shot. So that's the silly thing that stood out. I guess the other thing that kind of stood out for me is almost more theme wise, and it comes up again in a huge way in Godfather 3, is just the idea of legitimacy, of the way power is wielded and how we consider one exercise of power to be illegitimate and another exercise of power to be legitimate when both of them have, you know, fairly violent and catastrophic ends of so it was kind of standing out to me a little bit when I was thinking about, you know, the political angle, I guess, of this film. And then of course when you get to Godfather 3, that is the story of Godfather 3, I think.
Yeah, Coppola talks about on the audio commentary for the part two as each one being an ascent to a higher reign of power. We're entering politics in the second one, and then the church in the third. So we may as well, I don't want to dwell on it, but we may as well talk about Godfather Part Three. We may as well complete the series. As this episode is itself kind of a sequel to a fairly recent episode we did on One from the Heart, which led to Coppola taking on a lot of projects, to working very hard in the 80s to make back lost money. You know, Godfather Part Three was kind of as a possibility in his back pocket all that time. It was finally turned into a film that was released in 1990, which it earned somewhat mixed reviews, and its reputation, I believe, has only diminished over the years. I saw it in
until
the theater.
Recently, I think.
Well, I saw it and I kind of talked myself into thinking it was as good as the others. But I feel like, I think as Scott was saying, I think very recently there's been another reappraisal, particularly with Coppola releasing a new cut of the film, which I have not seen. That is the one I have not seen in a while. What's everyone else's take on Godfather Part Three? Perhaps Jason, you said you saw it recently.
I did. Well, I saw my initial take, which sort of is the one that you stick with for a good long while. You know, I saw it in such close proximity to seeing the first two films for the first time, again, within those first few weeks, that I oddly have always been warmer towards it than a lot of other people. And I think that really has to do with the question of sort of the period of time over which you have to build up expectations and hope, and thus are capable of disappointment. Of course, having seen it in close proximity, I knew it was not the film that the first two had been, but, you know, I didn't have 16 years of looking forward to be too worked up about its relative lack of quality. I've always thought that it's a fine film that clearly had been, you know, I had read the production stuff at the time. Like it was one of those things where, you know, you've been waiting 16 years on it, but now we're going to go with it and you have to get it done in 6 months. Like, it had a really rushed production and post-production period because they were really trying to get it into theaters by Christmas. And I think that certainly affected some of the editing of the picture. I think if he'd had longer to sit with it in script phase and in editing phase, it could have been stronger. I think Sophie is just really bad in it. And I mean, and she wasn't an actor. Like, it's not, you know, but I've always felt that if Winona Ryder hadn't had to drop out, if she had played that role initially, it would have been a stronger film. But there's also a lot in it that I think really works. I think Andy Garcia is great in it. I think Pacino's performance is really terrific. I think all of the sort of ascension through the, you know, the halls of power and the Vatican stuff is really fascinating. And I have seen the Godfather Coda, the new cut, and I think it is far better. I think there are just a couple of very minor tweaks that he makes and reshuffling that really improve the overall quality of the film. The main one being, you know, that there's a scene that's like a half hour into the movie where he's, you know, that's sort of the power powwow with their Vatican contact that is moved to the beginning of the movie in a way that it ends up very directly paralleling the Godfather 1's opening sequence and echoing, you know, the scene with the senator near the beginning of Godfather 2 that really realigns the entire movie in a way that it's sort of an astonishing testament to the power of just very minor edits. So I've never hated 3. I've always thought it is at least worthwhile. And I do think that the new cut is an improvement as well.
I think the confession scene alone kind of justifies existence.
Yes.
It's an amazing moment. And there's other really strong elements in that film. Although, again, it's been years since I've seen it. It's weird thing about to me is it looks so different.
Yeah.
Gordon Willis shot it, but it has a totally different texture.
It's very
and look
slick.
To it. Yeah, it's not of a piece with the other two.
It looks like a 1990 release. It looks like
looks like kind of his work leading up to it too. I mean, there was a kind of a gloss that he was to some of his 80s films. I mean, Tucker was right; would have been the film pretty close to it or right
that's
before.
A few years before, but
it was like 87 was Tucker or something or 80. Something.
Yeah, no, it was 87 because I. No, wait, what year did Die Hard come out?
Because 88.
I remember,
88.
Yeah, okay, because I remember I talked to my friends in the scene that and Tucker, and they wanted to see Die Hard.
Those are both good films.
Both good movies.
Well,
Tucker's my favorite of his 80s movies. I love that movie. But,
yeah,
but
I liked, Peggy Sue, but you know.
Peggy Sue's a good one too. Anyway, that's you got your guy in there. I mean, I'll be brief about Godfather 3. I mean, I that was one I saw before it came out. I was working as a projectionist at a theater and they wanted me to look at it, just look at the print that they had, which is something we did pretty commonly to make sure that it looked and sounded like it was supposed to. And so I saw it all by myself well before it came out, which of course was an extremely exciting thing for me to be doing.
Sure.
And I was very much influenced by that potentially and being absolutely wowed by it. And then maybe seeing it later and thinking it wasn't quite as good as I'd remembered. But I do have a lot of affection for it. And I saw it again recently. And I think that there are obvious flaws, but tremendous merit too. And a very deep tragedy too. I mean, I think as much as we might make fun of the whole dad moment, that opera sequence is very well put together, and the tragedy of that loss is massive, even with a performance that is kind of disappointing. I don't know. I think it's worth revisiting. I'm kind of excited to see this newer cut. I think to see you know what kind of reaction I might have to it.
Well, I think we can all agree that The Godfather Part Two is a lot. You don't have to make quite as much of an argument for it as Godfather Part 3. It's easier to agree upon. And we will talk about it more in the second installment of this pairing. For now, we're going to move on to feedback, which we'll address after a short break. Now it's time for feedback, where we answer any questions and respond to any comments about our episodes or anything else in the world of film. We recently ran a format-breaking episode on Strange Days and the fate of movies that have become borderline unavailable, either on streaming platforms or the physical media has gone out of print or whatever. They've disappeared, more or less. We received several responses along the lines of this letter, so we'll let it stand for all of them. Scott, can you read that?
Mike from Cleveland writes, I recently noticed something about how you talk about the availability of movies featured on the show. I've been thinking about it for the past few weeks, and then today, when listening to your great episode about Strange Days, a movie I loved when it came out and saw twice in the theater but never since, it struck me again. I know most viewers watch movies via streaming services. However, there are many, like me, that still have an old DVD or Blu-ray player, or even a 4K player. For those of us who can still play physical media, the public library, and this is all in caps, is a great place to find movies. Popular movies, rare ones, movies for kids, foreign films from around the world. I borrow movies from the library all the time. Where I live in Cleveland, I have access to 3 different but excellent library systems, all with great collections. The downtown branch of the Cleveland Library System, which I visit often, even has a dedicated Criterion section with hundreds of Criterion releases. And sure enough, I can borrow a Strange Days DVD anytime. I know we don't all have access to such well-curated library collections, but your local library may surprise you, especially if it's been a long time since your last visit. Wear a mask, please, he advises. I'm afraid most people don't even think about libraries anymore, which is a shame, because they're still out there, staffed by dedicated smart people who want to help you find great art. And they're one of the last vestiges of free, truly public spaces we have. A rare thing indeed.
Yeah, I think we did at least touch on libraries, but I'm glad that people, we were called out on this as the husband of someone who's not a librarian, but who holds a library degree and works for the American Library Association.
Shame is deepest on you.
For years, I probably should have dwelt on this longer. So yes, go libraries. I think we can all agree on that. I mean, Jason, I know you work out of the library quite a bit, so I know you're a fan, right?
A lot. Well, yeah, the one thing I will say specifically to this point is that anyone who's listening who lives in New York and is not aware, the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts, which is at Lincoln Center, not only is a tremendous sort of research space and all of the great things, the DVD collection at that location is as good as the best stocked video store of that era. Like every time I go there, which is often, I leave with an armload. It's a tremendous resource that's full of old titles, it's full of classics, full of foreign stuff, and really a lot of things. They, for a good long while, bought every Warner Archive release that came out. You know what I mean? Like every KL Studio Classics release. So some of this stuff that really does only exist on Blu-ray, on DVD, they have there. I never miss an opportunity to encourage my fellow New Yorkers to take advantage of this incredible resource.
The only complaint I have about the Chicago library system when it comes to movies is I don't think they've ever brought in Blu-rays. So it's all DVDs. And,
that's pretty second city behavior, I gotta say.
Well, I don't know.
You know?
But
the other thing, too, is that, if you want to stay home, I mean, there's Canopy now. If you're
we
that
don't have
system,
Canopy here in Chicago.
We have Hoopla.
We have Hoopla, which is good.
Which is too, fine, though. I do have a certain amount of Canopy envy, particularly with the Wiseman. Are the Wisemans even on there? Are they still on there?
Because I don't think New York has it anymore. Do you?
We don't. No, the New York Public Library and Canopy severed their relationship. Frankly, not long before lockdown began, which was not the best timing imaginable.
People could just settle in and watched. Watch some Wiseman films.
Watch some Wiseman,
because those are hard ones to see.
Well, some grousing aside, libraries are great. So our Strange Days episode also invited one reader to bring up a bigger related question, which I will now read. Matt writes, I'm a huge fan of the show, and your recent episode on Strange Days prompted me to watch the movie for the first time through legally dubious but morally sound means. While I had known of this movie, I had never seen it. I distinctly remember really disliking the original trailer, which features a greasy Ralph Fiennes talking directly to the camera, giving the audience the same have you ever jacked in, have you ever wire tripped spiel that he gives a potential client in the movie. Strange Days was released in 1995, the same year as Hackers, The Net, and Johnny Mnemonic, and the trailer made it look like another techno thriller with corny, instantly dated slang and an already tired premise. I remember hating this trailer. I really enjoyed the movie on my first watch last night, but it made me wonder if the trailer contributed at all to its commercial failure. Do you think this trailer works for the movie that we get? What are some of your favorite movies that were severely underserved or misrepresented by their trailer, which might have led to audiences staying away? Here's the one I always wonder about is if I would feel differently about the movie What Lies Beneath if I had not seen this trailer and seen it many times leading up to it, and not at the time recognizing that it reveals a huge spoiler about the film on which, you know, makes you rethink everything you know about a particular character. I'm trying to be a spoiler for, you know, trying to keep this spoiler free for this, you know, 20 plus year old movie. But I, you know, having a certain appreciation for Robert Zemeckis and such now more than then, even I wonder if I would feel differently if it had not been spoiled for me. Maybe I could see it now and find out, but at the time I thought it was kind of a shrug.
That's interesting. I can't think of any specific examples, because like I can think of examples of trailers I really like that went way out on a limb and may not have sold anyone on the movie. Uh-huh. Like, my favorite trailer of all time is...
Minus Man?
The Minus Man. Yeah, that's a great trailer.
Oh, right. No, it wasn't that one. It's the trailer for Real Life by Albert Brooks, which is in three... Which is him behind a desk, and then everything goes into 3D, and it's just... you gotta see it. It's an amazing trailer that barely gets into what the actual movie is about. So I don't think it's selling people on Real Life, which, you know, I don't know if that was ever going to be like a box office smash or anything, but the trailer itself is kind of a work of art. What bothers me, it puzzles me, I guess, is the trailers that really just give everything away that happens in the movie. Yeah. Like, you just know, and that's common. And what makes
it always has been. Also, if you right. really go back and look at like
trailers are so
trailers in the 40s and 50s. Oh my God, they're
worse.
Thing.
Wait, they're worse. They're longer.
Oh, the Carrie trailer, the Chinatown trailer, like have the closings of the movies in them. Yeah.
But
Sweet Smell of Success is one where you don't, you know, almost feel like you don't need to watch the movie after watching it. Right. But you should.
Yeah, I guess the thing that bugs me about it is that you can't, you know, as a critic, you get yelled at for writing the premise of a movie now, you know, and yet the trailers themselves give away a tremendous amount of the film, and I don't really get that, you know. I mean, I guess again, these are people who know their business more than me, but I don't see a movie being helped all that much by people feeling having the experience of the entire film in a 3-minute stretch.
So, well, yeah. Jason, describe for us, for listeners who weren't seeing every art house release in 1999, what the Minus Man trailer was like and how it hit.
It's like a little short film where it's nothing that's in the movie. It's just two people who saw the movie on a date talking about the movie afterwards. And then it sort of goes in a couple of interesting places, but it's just like, it's this idea of people talking about the movie instead of like showing the movie, which in an interesting way, it's kind of a throwback. Like there would be movies, you know, trailers in like the 40s and sort of the early days of it where you would just see, you know, like everyone's talking about the latest motion picture from, you know, that kind of thing. But it also has its own sort of strange, muted, almost ominous tone. I don't know. It's a hard trailer to describe, but it's on YouTube. Like, it's very easy to see.
No slight against this Minus Man, which I remember being fine. It is better than the Minus Man itself.
yeah. The other thing too about these trailers that give away the whole movie is that, especially now in the age of the, you know, the streamable, downloadable trailer, people watch these over and over and over again when they're really excited about a movie. So to drop something in that someone who's seen it several times will be distracted by knowing is coming, it seems like a very silly decision. Like, I remember seeing Castaway, not to turn this into a Zemeckis bash fest, but having seen the trailer a lot of times just from going to the movies a lot. That was in, you know, my pre-critic days when I just went to the movies every weekend. So I'd seen that trailer a gajillion times. I knew he was going to make it off the island because there were shots in the movie of him, like, you know, running down the rainy street for Helen Hunt. It's like it's completely, of course, you knew he was going to make it off the island, but still, it's to have that completely drained is not, right. You know, it's disruptive to the spell the motion picture is supposed to cast.
To echo Matt, though, I also remember the trailer for Strange Days being highly mockable. And for some of those same reasons that he points out, is it is, you know, if you don't understand the context or the character.
The language.
Yeah. And it did come out in the midst of a lot of, I mean, I know some of these films have developed a cult following over the years, but it was in the midst of a lot of techno thrillers that were largely, you know, I'll just say closer to the Lawnmower Man than the Matrix, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the Strange Days is, you know, I mean, it really kind of saw things coming a little bit better now than a lot of those other movies did.
Because you wouldn't know it from the trailer necessarily.
No, but I mean, I think I would say though that the conceit of a trailer like that is not bad. It just, you know, it's all about execution. I mean, I think the idea of like taking someone who, you know, we know to be charismatic, or Ralph Fiennes, charismatic actor, you know, trying to sell the audience on the idea of this drug that delivers experience is not a bad pitch. I mean, because you watch Strange Days, you're like, God, what would that be like? What would it be like to actually experience the world through somebody else's eyes? But then, you know, again, it's a matter of how it's actually executed. And I think he's probably right that it's not a very good trailer.
We need to move on at some point, but I'm trying to think of an example of a movie that really was poorly served by its trailer.
Crimson Peak.
I don't remember the trailer for that. I remember liking the movie quite a bit. I don't remember the trailer.
Yeah, the movie's terrific, that movie is so much, if I may borrow the verbiage of the kids today, is so much of a vibe. And and the pleasures of it are so hard to encapsulate in a 2.5 minute attempt to summarize a plot. You know, it looks like a very kind of generic gothic movie you've seen a gajillion times. And I remember not really being all that interested in it from that trailer and then seeing the movie and sort of having my socks knocked off.
All right. Well, we always appreciate when listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll look at The Many Saints of Newark, which flashes back to the early days of another famous fictional gangster, Tony Soprano. Look for that episode next Tuesday, or you can subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. If you want to hear it without ads and while surrounded by extra Next Picture Show written and recorded content, come support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. Find us at nextpictureshow.net and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, keep your friends close, your enemies closer, and keep the banana daiquiris flowing.
And as the sun, most sons are like imitators of their father. So we're back again to the father. If he is guiding in the right way, the son is definitely gonna be all right.